There's something about mountains. We see the story of the Ten Commandments, this covenant, unfold on a mountain, right? There's something about the mountains. When you see them from a distance reaching up toward the sky, there's something that stirs in us. When you see those white peaks up above when the land down below is still warm, to climb up a mountain, to see the vast expanse, the wilderness stretching out before us, it reminds us of the scope of things, of how small we really are and how big the world really is. When we see the mountains, there's this sense of awe, even fear and wonder. There's this majestic reverence, right? A sense that there's something more to it all, something bigger than ourselves. In a word, there's a sense of holiness. So it's no surprise that when the Israelites finally come to meet God, when God chooses to make this key covenant with them and give the Ten Commandments, that it's not on some level, random plain or average valley, but it's on a mountain. It's here that God chooses to make this covenant. God says these beautiful words of promise to them before the text we just heard. God says to the people, "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you up on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession out of all the peoples. Indeed, the whole earth is mine, but you shall be for me a priestly kingdom and a holy nation." A beautiful promise from God. Now, mountains already feel pretty special, right? They feel pretty sacred. There's this sense of awe. But for some reason, God takes that sense that we have and pushes it so much further in this story. We caught a glimpse of it, but if we read a little bit more right before the Ten Commandments are given, we hear even more that there was thunder and lightning. There was a thick cloud on the mountain and a blast of a trumpet so loud that all the people who were in the camp trembled. Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. The smoke went up like the smoke of a kiln, while the whole mountain shook violently. As the blast of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses would speak and God would answer him in thunder. Quite the spectacle, right? Why does God go so big, so bold, so grand in this situation? I think it's to show the people, to show us that this is a serious thing. This is a big deal. This is not just life and death important, you see. This is life and death important for all generations to come, for all future generations. God is serious here. It also goes to show the Israelites, who maybe needed to be reminded or needed to see that the God of Israel is not some paltry idol, some tiny thing made of stone or gold that people claim divinity. This is the real God of the universe, the creator of all that is. So it's in this context that God gives them the law, the Ten Commandments, the Torah. And after all the smoke and the thunder and the trumpet blasts and the seriousness and the gravity of this situation, only 10 commandments come down with Moses and are given. And at first glance, they seem, well, not so bad, right? There's only 10. We can take care of that. No problem. It's not that hard after all. There's 10 things. So you kind of start to think at them at first, and you think, okay, well, worship no other gods. Check. Especially if you were there with Israel and you saw the smoke and fire, you'd probably think, yes, definitely, we've got this one. No problem. Don't take the Lord's name in vain. Not too hard to do unless we stub our toes once in a while, but other than that, we're good. I think about the Sabbath. Well, I work here, so I'm going to be here anyway. It's not a big deal for me. Then we go on and look at the rest. Don't kill. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Check, check, check. I'm doing great so far. Don't bear false witness against your neighbor. I've never even been called to court, so I'm good with that one as well. Don't cover your neighbor's house. I don't know if God knew this when the Ten Commandments came, but all the houses in my neighborhood are the same, so there's not much to covet, really. I'm good still. Then we get to don't covet your neighbor's slave or donkey or oxen. None of my neighbors have those things, so I am good. It's easy. At least it can seem that way at first, but we know that's not the whole story. As these simple-looking 10 commands get unpacked throughout the rest of the Torah, the law, and then later on we realize they're not so simple after all. And then along comes Jesus, and in Matthew 5, he says some problematic things from my simplistic view of these commands. He says things like, "You've heard it said in those in ancient times, you shall not murder, but I say to you that if you are angry with a brother or sister, you will be liable to judgment. If you insult a brother or sister, you will be liable." He goes on to say other things like this. All of a sudden, they look a little tougher to hang on to, right? But then I think we're Lutherans, and Lutherans are all about grace, so we could look to Luther, and then it should get a lot easier. So I got out my trusty, really big, heavy, to make me look smart Lutheran book, and there's Luther's Large Catechism. You know, most of us are probably familiar with the Small Catechism that we teach in Confirmation, but he also wrote the Expanded Large Catechism, where he goes into great detail about the commandments. For the first commandment, for example, he says this: "Anything on which your heart relies and depends, I say that is really your God." Well, I'm in big trouble because there are a lot of things that I depend on in my life that don't seem to be God, right? If we look at what Luther says about the commandment that says, "Do not steal," I like to think, well, I don't steal, I'm fine. But Luther unpacks it more, and he says, well, this commandment is not only violated if we do evil, but also if we have the opportunity to do good to our neighbors and fail to do so. He says, for example, if you send a naked person away when you could clothe them, you might let them freeze to death. If you see anyone who's suffering from hunger and you have the means but do not feed her, you have let her starve. Luther isn't a lot of help either. It seems all of a sudden these simple Ten Commandments are not just hard, but almost impossible, right? Seem impossible to live up to. So we have to wonder, why would God give this covenant and this promise that seems impossible for us to live up to on our end? Well, I think, in a way, it short circuits this human thing that we all tend to do. We have this bad habit of convincing ourselves that we are good enough, that we deserve it, that we have earned it. And the law points out our flaws and shows us, it short circuits this temptation to trust in our own righteousness rather than the righteousness of God, revealing just how far away we are if we try to go it alone. Did you ever notice how the Israelites continue messing up a lot? Like a lot, right? They seem like such a forgetful and ungrateful people. I mean, they're freed from slavery, from the hand of Pharaoh, and the next thing we know, they're complaining to Moses that they're going to die at the Red Sea. So God miraculously parts the Red Sea, and they're saved, and they celebrate for about 5 minutes, and then they complain that they're going to die of hunger. So God says, all right, and gives them manna from the heavens. And they say, this is great, God, but we don't particularly care for the menu. We would like some meat, please. So God gives them quail. And then the next thing you know, they say, but now we're thirsty. And it seems to me that the Israelites are like a collective three-year-old asking over and over again. But on a much more grave note, later on, they seem to totally forget that they were once oppressed, abused, enslaved. And they begin to recreate the very same systems of oppression that God had freed them from back in Egypt, with a few elite on top clinging to power and greed, oppressing those who are weaker or poor. And injustice, greed, and slavery become just as rampant among God's people, Israel, as they were in Egypt. Unfortunately, this story seems all too familiar for me for today. How quickly we can forget, too. At least I can. I know I tend to forget things. I was recently reminded, and I had forgotten, that it was just a handful of generations ago when there were native peoples that belonged to the land on which I now live and call mine. I forget that although slavery technically had ended 100 years prior, that the civil rights movement happened within the lifetime of my parents and many of you here as well. I was reminded of this when we had watched the movie Selma at my last church in South Carolina with other AME churches and then talked about the movie and our experience afterward. And a woman stood up and said, "I was there. I marched with Dr. King on that bridge. Not so long ago, but how quickly we can forget." And when people forget their history, it seems that they tend to just repeat the mistakes of their ancestors. But there is hope, and that hope lies in this covenant promise that we hear in Deuteronomy, or in Exodus today. See, when God makes this covenant, this promise, it's interesting, the language is, you shall be. You shall be a holy people, a royal priesthood. You shall be my treasured possession. God's saying, you will become these things because of what I will do, because of what I will make you. See, God didn't pick Israel because Israel was already special or good or holy. Rather, Israel becomes special and good and holy because of what God has done in and through them, because God chose them. In fact, one could go so far as to wonder if maybe God didn't pick this particularly stubborn and rebellious group to be able to reveal God's steadfast love, because every time they fail, God's covenant promise and commitment to loving them is made that much more visible, because this love that God gives in covenant is a love that cannot be broken. God's mercy and grace is made that much more visible through their weakness. Perhaps this is why God picked me. Perhaps this is why God picked you. Not because we are good, not because we deserve it, but precisely because we aren't and we don't, that we will mess up. But that's to make God's great love and grace visible through us and our lives and our story and what God does in us. We have to remember the words of Jesus in John's gospel that Jesus said, "You did not choose me. No, I chose you." Thanks be to God.